Access Cast, an Accessibility initiative, presents Unstoppable Mindset, the podcast where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. Hi, I'm Michael Hinkson, Chief Vision Officer for Accessibility and the author of the number one New York Times bestselling book, Thunderdog, the story of a blind man, his guide dog, and the triumph of trust. Thanks for joining me on my podcast as we explore our own blinding fears of inclusion, unacceptance, and our resistance to change. We will discover the idea that no matter the situation or the people we encounter, our own fears and prejudices often are our strongest barriers to moving forward. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is sponsored by Accessibility. That's ACCESSIBE. Visit www.accessibility.com to learn how you can make your website accessible for persons with disabilities and to help make the internet fully inclusive by the year 2025. Glad you dropped by. We're happy to meet you and to have you here with us. Welcome to another edition of Unstoppable Mindset. Thanks for joining us this week. We have a guest I've been looking forward to for quite a while. His name is Mike Paciello, and I'm not going to tell you a whole lot about him because he gets to do that himself, except I will tell you that he's very deeply involved in the web accessibility world. Why do we deal with web accessibility a lot on this podcast, and why do I continue to bring it up? Because if you've listened to many of these podcasts, you know that there is an ever-widening gap between websites that are accessible and those that are not. And it is something that we all need to deal with because there are so many people in this world who don't get to access all the websites that everyone else can access for one reason or another. Mike has been very deeply involved in dealing with those issues for a lot of years. And I'd like to introduce you to him now, and we can talk more about it. Mike, welcome to Unstoppable Mindset.
Thanks, Mike. Great to be here.
So how did you even get involved in this? I mean, you are sighted. You, as far as I know, don't have any what people would call physical disabilities and all that. So how did you get involved in all this?
Well, it's a long and winding story. That probably folks have heard many times in the past, but I worked at a computer company that no longer exists anymore. It maybe exists in parcels at HP, but it was Digital Equipment Corporation back in the 80s.
Just this morning was reading something from someone on a list where they were talking about the old Dectalk synthesizer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I know the guys
memories.
Yeah, I know the guys that worked on that, and Tony Vitale was one of the lead engineers on that. And Tony and I were good friends. He passed away several years ago from ALS. Ironically enough, he discovered it while he was at the CSUN conference. I think this was in the late 90s, may have been early 2000s. But at any rate, I was working as a technical writer at Digital in the mid 80s, right through the early 90s. And was asked to take on a project voluntarily, which involved providing our computer software documentation. We did mostly operating system software to the National Braille Press in Boston. And I just thought it was interesting. And so I followed up, and they said, maybe you'll get a request once or twice a year. I hadn't had the project for more than a few hours, and I got a call right away from Bill Reeder, who was
the
director. Yep, you know Bill.
Yeah. Yes.
And he said, "Hey, we need this, and this. Can you bring these down?" And I said, "Sure, I'd be happy to." And so I hand carried the physical publications, which, as I found out, they would then take and transcribe into and reproduce in Braille. And Bill was awesome. He gave me a complete tour of, you know, the factories and the offices and what they did. And right away, he started talking about, you know, screen reader. It wasn't screen reader technology. It was Braille translation software at that particular time. And so that piqued my interest. And I I, at the same time I was doing that, I also happened to be working in the very first instances of markup language. This is pre-SGML, which as anyone that knows, the standard generalized markup language was the precursor to HTML, which is makes up the web. But it was actually a markup language used to basically mirror what an editor, a physical editor of a written publication would do. You know, take a document from an individual, divide it up into logical portions on you know within a page. So this is a paragraph, this is a list, this needs to be indented, this is a title, this is a heading, that those type of things. And now SGML could do that electronically. And at the time, I specifically was working on a project that involved converting our electronic documents at digital into PostScript, which, if anyone knows what PostScript is, that's pre-PDF.
Yes.
So I thought to myself, if we can do these electronic conversions from basically a text markup file to a PostScript file, which is, you know, kind of a graphical page, right?
Right.
Why not output it to Braille? And that led me on my quest to go figure out how to do that.
And, so what did you end up doing?
Well, of course, I had established a few contacts because of this arrangement that Digital had with the National Braille Press. And one of those contacts was George Kircher.
Mm.
Anyone that knows anything about this business knows that George is a champion and a hero and just one of the greatest human beings I've ever known and met. And it's great to be called a friend and a colleague of his.
And so George was the person who kind of really was the proponent of the DAISY format, which is used today, not only in audio recordings to make them fully accessible and navigable, but he did it for Braille as well.
That's right. That's exactly right. And I'll tell you, a lot of people remember George for when he worked for, there in New Jersey and Princeton, for the Blind Index, RFB.
Recording.
Right.
RFB, now Learning Ally, right.
Right, right, exactly. However, before he joined RFB&D, he had his own little company called Computerized Books for the Blind.
Right.
And so I established that contact with him. He and I started talking about markup languages. He pulled in a couple of other people like Joe Sullivan from Duxbury Systems and Yuri Rubinsky, who was the president and CEO of SoftPot, which was a major producer of SGML editing software. And we formed together with many other colleagues, also international colleagues, what was a working group called the International Committee for Accessible Document Design. And we did that in the early 90s.
So you put some processes together, and how successful were you at being able to get PostScript translated into Braille?
Well, no. As far as I know, there was no success there.
Yeah.
The story with PostScript is, you know, Adobe eventually converted everything to PDF, and that's where the success, so to speak, relatively speaking, came in play. Adobe actually had members that were part of our International Committee for Accessible Document Design, and they got involved. In fact, their lead engineer at that time was Carl Orthy, and Carl met with George, myself, and another great colleague who worked with me at that time at Digital, TV Rahman, and we looked at ways of taking the PDF and converting it to something that was accessible. So there's no real story, as far as I know, around PostScript. It's all about PDF at that level.
It's interesting. You had a lot of good beginnings and laid a lot of foundations, but today it seems like a lot of the accessibility that we're seeing is still somewhat sporadic and spotty, in that not everything gets to be put into or can easily be put into an accessible form. Even with Adobe, there are a lot of documents that are released and created by various people that aren't accessible. Why is it that Adobe and other organizations don't really follow through and try to create native accessibility right from the outset?
Yeah, well, you know what that is? It comes down very simply to, it's a business decision. Corporations, for all intents and purposes, they've got a mindset. They're all about reporting back to their boards of directors, yeah, and reporting profits. I mean, it's just business is business, especially here in this country, where we're driven, you know, by the markets. And so businesses look at, and I've yet to see this not be true, even for those companies that I believe excel where accessibility is concerned. Businesses have never been able to figure out really how to turn accessibility, as you and I know it, into a business value proposition. They haven't figured out how to make money out of it. There are all kinds of numbers that are thrown out there about discretionary income by people with disabilities, but it doesn't come down to that. It's channels, it's business lines, we're talking about, you know, companies don't want to talk about making business unless we're talking about billions of dollars now. And then, you know, it won't take much longer, looking at the recent profit reports by Apple and Amazon, that we're going to be talking about trillions of dollars. Mm-hmm. So if we can't generate that kind of thing, then a business really doesn't want to invest in it. And secondarily, designing, architecting, developing, all of the engineering life cycle or product life cycle disciplines that are associated with ensuring that whatever it is that we're building, and I'll just use just a software environment because that's what I'm most familiar with. Whatever software platform or interface that we're designing or developing, it has to be accessible. They're not doing it out of the box. It's mm-hmm. not being done at the concept, you know, conceptual design and architectural, and then followed all the way through. And if what I'm doing right now is I'm using kind of a gesture to show, you know, from the beginning all the way to the end of the life cycle, there, every piece of that needs to be accounted for, where ensuring something is usable and accessible to a variety of people with disabilities and the persona types associated with it. And companies just typically don't make that kind of investment unless someone at the top is driving it. And, you know, you can look at, I think Microsoft is a good company right now to kind of hold up there, because I believe that they've done a great job at raising the bar, because all of it's being driven by Jenny and by their CEO. Right. He himself has, I think, at least one son with a disability. So he's got a personal connection to it. But you don't see that in 90% of most businesses. So again, like I said, it's a value cost analysis that, you know, from an accessibility standpoint, it's probably never going to really truly wash. Now that doesn't mean, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, that doesn't mean it shouldn't be done, and that doesn't mean that we shouldn't tackle this pervasive, global challenge using other means by which to, you know, kind of change the world and change thinking. And I really think that's probably another big piece of it.
But even with Microsoft, now with new Windows 11, there are a lot of things that are technically accessible, but they're not obvious, and they're not obviously located so that one can see them. You know, as an example, it used to be, in as late as Windows 10, if you wanted to go to what we're now calling, even with Windows, an app that's installed on your machine, you would hit the start button and then you could use the arrow keys to go down and find the app. But that's not the case in Windows 11 anymore. And there are additional keystrokes or other things that you need to do. They have not kept the same obvious process. And yes, it's accessible because you can find it, but is that really as usable? And was a lot of thought given to that when they were creating Windows 11? And it seems to me that Jenny has done a lot. And we're speaking, by the way, for those who don't know, of Jenny LaFleur, who is the chief accessibility officer for Microsoft. And Jenny is deaf. We met at a convention a few years ago, and obviously you work with her pretty well. But I just think that there are things that they're still not giving a lot of thought or as much thought as they should to some of the architecture and ways to make Windows as obviously usable as it should be.
You know, I mean, Mike, I can't deny that. I totally agree. I think, you know, what we see out on the web in terms of social networking, social marketing, we see what Microsoft wants us to hear, right? But we're not inside. And I am not at all surprised, because I hear this about a lot of the other, you know, big companies. Who is it? Was it Fast Company that just came out with this glowing article? And it mentioned, it was really kind of interesting. It mentioned Microsoft, Amazon, Google, Facebook, who else was in there? Apple, and all of these great and wonderful things that they do. And I mean, you can't deny the fact that they've made some awesome, steps forward and, and done some great things in behalf of the entire disabilities marketplace, right?
But of course.
But at the same time, you and I both know, I see every single day, if not hundreds, you know, dozens, you know, if not dozens, hundreds, or whichever way you want to look at it,
right,
of people who are saying exactly what you're saying. Yeah, great, but now I can't use Windows 11. I've seen that whole discussion on Windows 11. So what happened? Who's not watching the ball there? How can you not, at this point in the game, when you are in industry as mature as Microsoft is, including the accessibility space, how could you miss these things? You can't. So someone's making decisions that should either is not well-educated or well-versed in accessibility, or B, and I think this tends to be the more likely scenario, they're doing it because they're being driven by whatever financial incentives that they have, right?
Right. But here's another aspect of that. I agree that especially in this country, we tend to be very driven by the financial aspects of it. What about our stockholders? We've got to report directly to them, and they're the only ones who matter, which I'm not convinced is true, but that's what companies do. But when do we get to see companies believe it's as much about the cost of doing business to include people with disabilities, and we'll deal with blindness here, but in general, to include people with disabilities as it is others? Look at Adobe. If you install Adobe Acrobat, or if you look at a lot of the things that you can do with Acrobat and Acrobat DC today, we have Acrobat DC licenses, I do here. You get options for different kinds of languages. You get a variety of different kinds of settings. And obviously those were put in because people somewhere thought it was important to have more than English. And of course, part of that is you want Acrobat to be able to be marketed all over the world. But even in this country, you want Acrobat to be able to produce documents in English and Spanish and Chinese and Japanese and other languages as well.
Right.
But so there's a mindset there that's important. But I think part of the issue with corporate decisions is there isn't a mindset yet about dealing with disabilities, even though more than 20% of all people in this country and around the world have some sort of disability. There isn't a mindset of inclusion for those people yet.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, we often talk about culture. We often talk about acumen. I used to have a domain that was called thinkaccessibility.com. And it's true. The mindset is they're just not doing it. But I also feel like I kind of apologize because I haven't been able to come up with the right answer yet. But I used to talk in terms of, how do we change the world? I mean, that's what we're trying to talk about, right? We're talking about changing the world, change the world's mindset as it relates to people with disabilities and accessibility in terms of any kind of interaction or inclusive design. It doesn't matter whether it's hardware, software, wood, or paper, or electronic. The same thing is true all the way across the board. I still see buildings that are built and they don't meet the ADA standards.
Right.
Right. So what is it? I used to talk about, you know, back in the 90s, particularly, we went through this phase where alternative energy became, you know, a big thing. And many governments, many, many governments put billions of dollars into alternative energies for a lot of reasons, right? They want to stop fossil fuel pollution and things along those lines, right? The atmosphere, but there were a lot of reasons for doing it. But the governments and the people, the scientists behind it had the foresight, they saw a vision of what the world would be like in 50, 60, you know, 100 years and decades ahead. And from the standpoint of preservation, from the standpoint of, global warming, pollution, things along those lines, it became an intrinsic to life for every human.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't achieved that in the disability and accessibility world, in our world. We have not created a mindset that says we need to change the world, because if we don't, this is what's going to happen in the years to come.
Right.
Does that make sense?
It does. And, you know, part of the problem is the term disability is still, you know, we're great at redefining words, right? I mean, we've redefined diversity all over the place. And now diversity generally tends not to include disabilities.
Right.
But we haven't been able to define disability yet to not mean you're not able. And so it is a problem. And I'm just not sure how we're going to get around that. But somewhere we need to do that to get the mindset to shift so that people can truly understand and accept that just because a person has a different ability set than they, and it doesn't include some of the things that their ability set includes, that does go the other way as well. And it isn't all of a physical nature necessarily.
I totally agree. I'll tell you, what's also factually true is, you know, the profession, the business, and the community that you and I are part of is in and of itself kind of a civil rights notion, right?
It is. Absolutely.
Kind of. I mean, in the U.S., it's absolutely that. Actually, in most countries, it's absolutely. That's why you have, you know, ADA-like legislation and laws throughout the world. But here's the interesting thing about that. Every great civil rights movement, every great movement has always had a great leader and a vocal leader and a visible leader. And I've always thought that that's one of the things that we miss. We don't really have. We have some great leaders. We've got some great people out there. Jenny being one of them, for example. When I grew up, Alan Brightman was like my hero. He and Gary Moulton were just, you know, awesome. George Kircher, you know, to this day is. But we don't have, you know, a Martin Luther King-like individual, you know, a Mahatma Gandhi-like individual,
right,
who doesn't just bring the cause, but brings the recognition and creates change as a result of that. And so I still kind of think that that's something that we probably need in this industry to change the world the way that we want to change it.
Yeah, and the problem is that to bring the recognition, that take a Martin Luther King, the thing is there were some differences about him, but there were enough similarities between him and everyone else that people could rally around him. And I'm not sure that when you're viewing people as physically disabled or developmentally disabled, when you bring that disability in, there's a part of it that I'm not sure that anyone yet has figured out a way to get around. The closest person who I ever encountered, and I never met him personally, but a person who I think could have achieved that, although not in the exact same strident way that Dr. King did, would be Jacobus Tenbroek, the founder of the National Federation of the Blind. He was the deep philosopher and extremely vocal about it and very innovative, but he was blind. And I think that problem is what we face in terms of dealing with disabilities.
Yeah, I totally agree. So I mean, I think that's just one piece of the, you know, of the puzzle, so to speak, to try to solve this worldwide mindset that needs to be changed.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how we're going to get around it, because I think we also tend to not be violent, and we shouldn't be violent about what we do. But we do need to somehow cross this barrier, and maybe the way we need to do it is to be more forceful collectively and get people to notice. But there are things that companies could do. Take Apple. So Apple finally came to the realization, and it took in part the threat of a lawsuit to make it happen. But Apple finally took the iPhone and made it accessible, the iPod. And they even went so far as to make iTunes U available, although I don't hear as much about iTunes U today, but still, it was the method by which a number of people could get class lectures and so on. And they made all of that accessible. The problem that I see with what Apple did is that they didn't take that last step. That is to say, there is still nothing in the App Store today that mandates any level of accessibility for the apps that they allow to go through the store. And they could make an incredible change in mindset and shift in mindset if they would just say, your app has to have some level of accessibility. And that's going to be different for different kinds of apps. But at least I ought to be able to control apps that go through the store. And I recognize that a lot of apps are going to be graphical in nature, but they still ought to give me the ability to control the apps and manipulate the apps. And my example that I use are star charts. You know, I'm not going to see star charts, but for me to take the time to describe it to someone and describe what I want to get them to manipulate it, rather than me being able to manipulate it and then saying to someone, what do you see? I still don't even get that. And apps go in and out of accessibility in the App Store all the time. Apple could, with a fairly simple process, make accessibility as mandatory in the store as it does other things, it would seem to me.
Yeah, well, what companies do about their own products is definitely one thing. But again, I still think it comes down to dollars and cents. Sure. And they're not going to push any harder than they have to, because they just don't have the C-level people who should be, you know, putting this on their agenda and prioritizing accessibility the way it ought to be, as we see it, right?
Right. But what's the message there? The message, it seems to me, is still, you're still not really important enough for us to do that.
Oh, that's right. You're not a viable entity. Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt about that. They'll never say it, but in fact, right, that's really what's going on in the boardroom. Now, right, one thing that we tried to do have been unsuccessful up till now. But when Jim Tobias and I chaired the last 508 committee, one of the things that we had already laid groundwork for doing was implementing the 508 requirements, which include all the web accessibility requirements, into the Americans with Disabilities Act. Because the Department of Justice was a participant there. They were following what we were doing. And we made some good headway into it, but it came to an abrupt stop as a result of politics, frankly speaking.
Right.
My last meeting, ironically enough, at the White House was the day before the 2016 election. Yeah, 2016 election. And I listened to President Obama's chief technology officer and his chief science officer both talk about the plans that they were laying out for the next 4 to 8 years. And all those things got trashed after that election. So again, not really, in no way am I stating any kind of a political position here, because I don't. I stay out of politics. But I'm just saying, having been the chair, a co-chair rather, of a committee whose charter was to enhance the lives of individuals with disabilities by enhancing technology for accessibility, we lost quite a bit at that level. Now, will it ever get into ADA? I don't know. I really don't know. It's more or less been tabled. The Department of Justice position at this point is, well, you know, things are fair, you know, are out there for everybody to follow. They don't need enforcement. But the reality is lawsuits are going to keep coming until enforcement is mandated. And then corporations will do one or two things. They'll either comply because they'll have to obey, or they'll do what they typically do, which is they send lobbyist groups in and fight it.
Yeah. Well, right. And you bring up a really interesting thing regarding lawsuits, because lawsuits can be a powerful and valuable way to help the process if the litigation is brought for the right reason. Namely, we really want to help fix the problem. But we're also seeing a lot of lawsuits, and it's been going on, well, certainly before the ADA, but we'll use the ADA and our situations and experiences as the example. Lawsuits today are often filed by lawyers who just want to make a bunch of money. They're very frivolous lawsuits. I saw one last week where a lawyer decided to sue a company, actually a bunch of different companies, because they said their websites were inaccessible. And they used the same boilerplate on all of the lawsuits. And in reality, from the time the plaintiff, quote, looked at the website that I am aware of until the time the lawsuit was filed was about a month. And in that time, unbeknownst to the defendant or to the plaintiff, the company took action to make the website accessible because it was the right thing to do. So that by the time the lawsuit was filed, in reality, the claims were totally baseless because the website had become accessible and usable, demonstrably speaking. But yet the lawsuit was still filed. And there are so many of those frivolous lawsuits. It seems to me that one of the things that we ought to figure out ways to do is to get bar associations and others to go after these lawyers who are doing these frivolous lawsuits, because they're not doing anyone any good.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. There are a lot of ambulance chasers out there. They've been out there for as long as I've been, in the software and web accessibility business. I mean, I don't know if we'll ever be able to change that unless we do there have been some inroads made in terms of how much a person can sue for and some of the motivations for it. But Yeah, I mean, it's sad, and unfortunately, they bring in individuals with disabilities, to be part of the suit itself, and that creates angst in the communities as well, right? So I mean, it's funny. I gave a talk at the UN years ago, on fear-based incentives, and I hate them. I mean, I have such disdain for any kind of fear-based incentives. But the fact of the matter is that we see it does affect change, right? So you've seen large corporations and organizations and educational institutions who have made the changes because they were forced to as a result of those lawsuits. I don't like it. I don't think anybody likes to be cornered, put into a corner and then have to fight out. It just gives accessibility and disabilities a bad name overall, but it is effective. So
Well,
that to say,
fear-based marketing is all around us. I mean, turn on a television and you hear commercials like your check engine light is going to turn red at some point, and then it's going to be too late. You have to get our car warranty now. I mean, fear marketing is all around us.
yeah, that's true.
And it
Yeah,
works.
it's ironic because it is kind of ironic that you're talking about that because we are kind of talking about messaging and marketing. It's one of the reasons why when I built Webable, one of the things that I really wanted to focus on was trust-based marketing. That anyone that I did business with has to be truthful in everything that they say and everything that they do. And so I've worked really hard on that focus. I'm actually updating our pages right now to add another a set of value statements associated with trust and truthful marketing, because I believe it's ironic. My drive here is to make sure that people with disabilities and consumers with disabilities, what they're being told or what they're being sold is, an accurate reflection of what a product can or cannot do. So, or what a service-based company says they can and will do. Because I believe, frankly speaking, very analogous to the lawyer, the ambulance chase lawyer scenario, is I believe that that individuals with disabilities, not unlike the elderly community, are often taken advantage of because they don't know everything that's going on. Their disability puts them into a situation where they often are not aware of what the true motivations of a corporation or organization really are.
And it's as important for those of us in the disability community to understand corporate dynamics and do as much as we can to become a part of the corporate world, because change does have to come from within, and it won't come unless we help bring it about and unless we work as hard as we possibly can to get other allies on the inside. But I still think ultimately it's going to require that mindset shift, and I'm not convinced that it needs to be a costly thing to bring about accessibility, especially if you create a native way to make it happen right from the outset. Then you're building it into the cost of doing business, which is what Apple did, of course, with the iPhone and the iPod and the technologies that it and the
Yeah,
Mac
and voiceover, right?
and VoiceOver. It,
Right,
it's a cost of doing business. And I'm not even sure I totally like that, but it's okay. It's a cost of doing business to make sure everyone can use the product. And I think that's a reasonable thing to do. But that's why I think that they need to take that last step and get to the point of recognizing that part of that same cost of doing business has to be to say to developers, you've got to have some sort of basic amount of accessibility, just like we do with the iPhone and the iPod and the Mac itself, because you're leaving people out. The problem is that Apple put itself in that position by being a policing agency for what goes into apps and how apps work. I understand, I haven't looked lately, but I understand that if you create a piece of software that looks like it has a Windows desktop, that was true of Windows 10 anyway, Apple wouldn't release it in the App Store because it didn't look Apple-ish enough and it looked too Windows-y, and of course their competitors. They have the ability to make, and they do make decisions based on what they choose.
Yeah, yeah, there's no doubt about that. Again, businesses are in the business of doing business, right? And that's why we have things, you know, like trademarks and copyright and patent infringements and patents and all of that. It's all proprietary systems, closed, open. That is the world that we live in today.
And it is.
As we started, as you said from the beginning, the sad part of all of this is that the decision makers, the architects, the designers are not really truly thinking about accessibility and building it in from the start.
And it would make it just, and it's not that hard to do if they would, but do it. Tell me about the Web Accessibility Initiative a little bit.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'll tell you as much as I know. I mean, I haven't, I've been on the fringes of it more or less for the last 15 years or so. But I tell you, the interesting story about the way is that I was working as a volunteer. I was working at Digital and working as a volunteer to kind of with MIT and the W3C to just kind of build some content. Leads, email lists, some resource information and just keep it there for accessibility. Organizations like Trace at which then under Greg Van Heiden was at the University of Wisconsin, now down at University of Maryland at Baltimore, I think that's where they're at. And WGBH here in Boston under Larry Goldberg's directorship. And CAST, they also were organizations that were kind of pulling together these resources around the web. And so while I was there, I came in contact with a few key people like Daniel Dadier and, of course, Tim Berners-Lee. I was working closely with Yuri Rubinsky before he passed in 96 and others, Dave Raggett, just a few other people that were there. And ultimately, you know, we started to talk about, you know, can we do something with this? At the same time, conversations were being carried on with the National Science Foundation and the Department of Education and a couple of European consortiums, including TIDE. And what happened was Tim, as I understand, was approached by either Vice President Gore or President Clinton at that particular time and said, hey, look, would the W3C, would you guys be interested in kind of building a project around people with disabilities and access to the web? And Tim came back to myself, Danielle, Jim Miller, Dave Raggett, and said, hey, do you guys think that we could do this? Would this be something that we could do? And ultimately that led to us putting together a plan and a proposal for an initiative. At the time, it was called the Web Accessibility Project, or WAP. And I never liked it. Never liked the name of it. You know, from a marketing standpoint, you know, a branding standpoint, I just knew it wasn't going to work. So when we decided that we were going to launch it in 1997, Danielle and I went back and forth. Okay, what can we name this whole thing? And I came up with WAI, W-A-I, mm-hmm. so that it was marketable, it was easy to say, and easy to brand. And Daniel liked it, and we went back, and in 1997, at the, I think it, what was it? Boy, I can't remember. I think it was the sixth or seventh Worldwide Web Conference. I think the seventh. I want to say seventh, but it had been sixth. I've got my stuff right over here on my other shelf. I can't see it right now. We launched it there at Stanford and Santa Clara, and that led to the launch of the initiative. We got funding, U.S. government funding, matching funds from MIT, and matching funds from the TIDE Initiative for 3 years. So we built a 3-year business plan for it. Ultimately, I changed jobs, and now Yuri had passed away in 96. It's now 1997. And I was the executive director of the Yuri Bidzhansky Insight Foundation. So under that notion, I went out and helped lead and build the Web Accessibility Initiative Program Office. And ultimately, that led to us hiring Judy Brewer, mm-hmm. who was in Massachusetts and had been very well known for her activity with her. Boy, I can't remember what the name of the organization was. I want to say the Mass Association for Disabilities. But she had led the effort to requiring Microsoft to ship Windows 95 with certain accessibility features into it. And so she was a great hire, to lead the office. I went back off and eventually left the Insight Foundation and started up my own company, TPG.
And now you've since fairly recently sold TPG, right?
It's already been almost 5 years.
2017. It has, hasn't it? What did TPG do? What did you form the company to do?
Yeah, so what I really wanted to do was form a professional services organization company that helped make web applications and software, regardless of the platform, usable and accessible to people with disabilities. So I built an initial team. We went through several iterations of the team before I could pull the right group of people together. But ultimately, that's what we did, and that's how I sold it. It became one of the most, if not the most well-known brand in software professional services around web and software accessibility in the world. And that led to the company at the time was VFO. Now known as Vispiro, and they acquired TPG specifically for that. We had the largest brand, not the largest company, but the largest brand, most well-known brand. And it was because we were built on a foundation of trust. Every client that we had came to us by referrals. We never did outbound sales ever. And we had lots and lots of repeat business, enough to keep, ultimately, I think when I sold it, we had about 40 or so people on staff. And some of the world's best in the world in this business. And I don't mind dropping any of their names because they're all out there. Several of them are there. Some of them have gone off and formed their own companies. I find that a little bit of a legacy thing. You know, like Carl Groves went off and had Tenon, and now he's with Level Access. Leonie Watson went out and started Tetralogical, and she's got, 7 or 8 members of her key team are all former TPG employees. Sarah Horton has gone off. She's doing her thing. So, and I've gone off and done mine. So there's been a lot of, it's kind of interesting, a lot of breakout companies from TPG.
And now you're doing WebAble.
And now I'm doing WebAble. Yeah, I'm kind of doing two jobs, right? WebAble and AbleDocs.
And you're married, so you have 3 jobs.
What's that?
And you're married, so you have 3 jobs.
I mean, I probably have 5 because I do a lot of
Yeah, there's that too.
Karen tells me I have like 5 jobs now. So, see? WebAble to AbleDocs, WebAble. It really started out at TPG. It was my idea to kind of build a marketing, but I wanted to, honestly, I built a news aggregate, which the front end of it is a news aggregate. But ultimately, I wanted to be a digital marketing, social networking marketing company strictly within the context of accessibility and disability. And that's where it's at.
And what is AbleDocs?
AbleDocs is primarily known for documentation accessibility across the board. So it's not just PDFs, it's Word, it's Excel, PowerPoint. We're dealing with Google Docs. But it is a company that is involved in digital accessibility. We've recently branched out and started building on our own web accessibility services. So we did an acquisition of WebKeyIT out in Perth, Australia. So then we brought them in And we're buying some tools and we're building some business along there. So I've been helping Adam Spencer, the CEO there at AbleDocs. Adam has a long history in documentation accessibility, and they're one of the world leaders in that. So I'm here to help them build their USN branch.
Pretty exciting, isn't it?
Yeah. It's startup all over again. So it's kind of fun from that standpoint, but a lot of hard work.
Well, and doing it in the COVID era, well, you get to do it at home. So there's lots of time to do it. So at least you just don't have to travel as much right now.
Honestly, that's the thing I miss the most. I love traveling.
Yeah, I do too.
I love traveling. I love speaking. I will go, you know, everywhere and anywhere to do that, you know, to kind of carry the mission. So I miss that the most.
I've never really minded being on airplanes, although I understand the whole issue with COVID right now, but I've never really had a problem with it. I enjoy traveling. I haven't been to a place yet that I couldn't find some things to like about it. And I've enjoyed everywhere I've gotten to go and all the people I've gotten to speak to and speak with and educate. Yeah, I miss it as well.
Yeah. Well, you and I saw each other down in Washington, D.C.
We did.
In Baltimore. So the NFB and at an M-Enabling. But I right after that, COVID started to break out again with the Omicron variant. So I stopped all travel. So right now, and I've done probably five or six other events since then. Right now, if all things work out, I'll be at CSUN.
Tell me about that. You're going to be the keynote speaker this year.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised. I got a call from CSUN, and they asked me, their executive director asked me if I would, Sandy Ploton asked me if I would consider. I was really shocked, to be honest with you. I haven't been at CSUN in, you know, in 4 years, right? In 4 years. Because my first wife passed away and I was at home for, I retired. After I sold TPG, I retired for, you know, for the better part of 4.5 years. You know, was caretaking for Kim and I really couldn't travel. So I did go to CSUN I haven't been to CSUN since 2018. Yeah, so it'd be 4 years now. So when they called, No, I can't think of it. Now I just lost her name. Oh, Sandy. Sorry. Sandy. When Sandy called me, I was really surprised. But she asked me if I would consider giving the keynote. And, you know, CSUN to me, CSUN's where I got my start in terms of networking and meeting people and getting involved in the community, not just on the national level, but on the international level. And that, I think, really spearheaded an awful lot for me in just about every other company that's out there. So it holds a very dear and near place to me. Harry Murphy's the director, the founder of CSUN. He and I are close friends even to this day. He retired over 10 years ago. And I've served on two advisory committees to CSUN over the years. So when Sandy, when she asked me, I said, yeah, I'd be happy to. So I've got.
What are you going to talk about? Can you give us a hint?
Well, the theme is try to make it a little bit interesting and intriguing. Accessibility users and the golden goose. Why trust is a vital digital asset. So it kind of goes with what you and I've been talking about.
What we've been talking about.
I did actually talk about this at M-Enabling. That I think. There are four key attributes of our business and our industry that need to be pervasive and promulgated and founded organizations and companies need to be fully immersed in, and that's innovation, collaboration, transparency, and trust. When those four attributes are built together, then I think we come out with a winning value proposition. And so I'm planning on using a trilogy of three stories, life stories, and bring them all together to show how they work out that way and how the value behind them.
Yeah, I've been in sales a long time, having started while working for Kurzweil and taking actually my first foray into sales was the Dale Carnegie Sales Course, which was a 10-week program once a week with live lessons and then other things during the week, but in Massachusetts. And the interesting thing and the overriding message that was constantly addressed during that course was that when you're selling, you're really advising, you're helping people, and you're establishing a rapport. And if you're doing it just to drive somebody to get your product, no matter what, then you're not selling the right way. It is all about trust.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt. Well, I think it's all four of these areas. I really, you know, especially because we're in high tech and a digital economy and digital society. So innovation is critical, right? Working together, right? Dispelling the mist associated with competition and collaborating, I think is crucial, especially again in our space. Transparency, you know, organizations need to be, you know, transparent about what they can and can't do. This is one of, I think, one of the, I don't know exactly where to attribute it to, but this much I do know, that people with disabilities are more than happy to work with you or your organization and your company. They're one of the first ones to jump on board and help you to make things usable and accessible, right? Because it benefits them. Right. But if you're not transparent with them, right? If you don't tell them what is truth, right? What my product can or can't do up front. And then worse, you market or you sell something that's not trustworthy or truthful, you're going to lose them as a community, and you're going to get bad vibes, because this is a very close knit community of individuals. So you've got to be transparent. It's okay to say, look, we've gone this far. I've done this much. Our plan is to go this far. And over the next 3 to 5 years is what we're going to do. People with disabilities will support you. They know you're making some inroads towards accessibility. They applaud the effort. Now, okay, so and they see your plan for the future. As long as you stay true to that mission, they're all in, and you'll get all the support in the world that you need from them. Which is why trust is so important. Because once you break those first three and you break the trust, then you got nothing.
In 2016, the Nielsen Company did a study of brand loyalty. And I don't know all the details of how it got commissioned or whatever, but one of the main points of the study was that persons with disabilities tend to be very brand loyal to those companies that include them, want to work with them, want to make their products available to them. And the brand loyalty is extremely strong because of that, which really goes along with exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I remember when Jacob did that study. I think I may have even been involved in it at some level. But yeah, it's absolutely true. I think people with disabilities, with maybe the strict exception of possibly elderly individuals, are the most brand loyal community of individuals, population of individuals ever, period. Yeah. When it works, sorry, you're not going to, you know, people, I mean, you know this, people are JAWS users, use JAWS because it works, right?
Right.
Even though JAWS is flawed, JAWS has bugs in it, right? Just like every other piece of IT I've ever seen. I've never seen a bug-free piece of software at all, technology. But once users got into it and started using it, it became very, very clear that this is going to be, even though they've got to pay for it, compared to, say,
NVDA,
right? They're very, very, very strongly loyal to it. And that's been true about all IT, frankly.
But NVDA is catching up. NVDA has come a long way and is working better. It is free, but it is still not JAWS.
No.
Nope. At least in people's minds, and nothing know, still is. Not JAWS. Yeah,
nothing is JAWS. I mean, JAWS, you know, Freedom owns 80% plus of that market. right? And in who have you seen over the years that have kind of gone by the wayside? Because they just
Sure.
can't penetrate the market, right? So,
and that
yeah.
will be the case as long as you said, the trust is there. If Vispero breaks the trust ever, that's going to be a big problem.
Yeah, I totally agree. I absolutely agree. They know it. I know it. And more importantly, all of the individuals individual disabilities, the users know it.
Yeah.
No doubt about it.
It's been that way. And I've been using JAWS for a long, long time and have watched how they've grown and developed. And they've done some things that have been challenging. But in the long run, it works, as you said. And that's what really is important.
Yeah. Yep. No doubt about it, Mike.
Well, we have been going on for an hour. How time flies when we're having fun. Mm-hmm. And I want to really thank you. If people want to reach out to you, how might they do that and learn more about the things you're doing and so on?
Well, if they want to learn about WebABLE and figure out what we're doing, I mean, we're on a sponsorship drive right now. So we're really looking for sponsors going into 2022. So you can send me email at Mike Paciello, Paciello, at webable.com. And if they want to contact me at AbleDocs for documentation, accessibility, and even professional services around software and web, then you can send me email at mpaciello@abledocs.com.
Well, we've been working together now for since September and October and M-Enabling and all that. And yep. I know you're talking with folks at Accessibe and there's a lot of some exciting stuff going on there. And hopefully I'll be able to work together and make this a little bit more of an inclusive world. And hopefully we'll be able to change mindsets and get people to maybe look at the world a little bit differently than they're used to and maybe look at it in a little bit broader and more inclusive way.
I totally agree. Totally agree.
Well, Mike, thanks very much for being here with us. And hopefully you'll have a chance and come back again. We'd love to have you back anytime. If you have anything you want to talk about, then let us know. We'll try to catch the speech at CSUN. Not sure whether I'm going to travel down there or not this year. We'll see. But hopefully we'll work it out somehow. But thanks again for being here on Unstoppable Mindset. And for those of you who want to learn more about us, you can find us at michaelhingson.com. That's michaelhingson.com/podcast. And you, wherever you heard this podcast, you can go anywhere where podcasts are hosted and released, and you can find us there. So join us next week for another edition of Unstoppable Mindset, wherever you are, wherever you happen to be at the time, and with whatever host you use. We'll be looking forward to seeing you then. Thanks for listening. You have been listening to the Unstoppable Mindset Podcast. Thanks for dropping by. I hope that you'll join us again next week and in future weeks for upcoming episodes. To subscribe to our podcast and to learn about upcoming episodes, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/podcast. Michael Hingson is spelled MichaelHingson. While you're on the site, please use the form there to recommend people who we ought to interview in upcoming editions of the show. And also, we ask you and urge you to invite your friends to join us in the future. If you know of anyone or any organization needing a speaker for an event, please email me at speaker@michaelhingson.com. I appreciate it very much. To learn more about the concept of blinded by fear, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/blinded by fear. And while you're there, feel free to pick up a copy of my free ebook entitled Blinded by Fear. The Unstoppable Mindset Podcast is provided by AccessCast, an initiative of Accessibe, and is sponsored by Accessibe. Please visit www.accessibe.com. Accessibe is spelled A-C-C-E-S-S-I-B-E. There you can learn all about how you can make your website inclusive for all persons with disabilities and how you can help make the internet fully inclusive by 2025. Thanks again for listening. Please come back and visit us again next week.